Danny, we've got a new NBA champion.
Got a champ.
Congratulations to the Oklahoma City Thunder, who won their first title. Pacers' Cinderella run ends one win shy.
I know the story should be Oklahoma City, and it is, ultimately. We'll celebrate them accordingly, and Shea deserved the MVP. That's all correct. They were that run in the third quarter to basically turn the game, and Indiana had no response. I can't stop thinking about Haliburton.
Yep.
Just heartbreaking. I mean, listen, they're real-life tragedies. We're all aware of that. We're talking sports within those relative circles. But, my God, just it's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking what happened to that guy. All he's trying to do is gut through it. It's reminiscent of Kevin Durant years ago with the strained calf leading to the Achilles. And I haven't seen an update on anything official with the injury, but you could see it in slow-mo. I mean, everything sort of snaps and stops working. You could see it through his sock and his shoe. And just like gut-wrenching that it happened. He's on fire to start the game at 3 threes in the first handful of minutes. And you're going, Indiana ain't going anywhere. And then that happens.
He had
God.
9 points as of 7 minutes into the game.
Yep.
He had 9 of the 16 for Indiana at the time. They were down by 2 points. And to your point, he was a game-time decision for Game 6 as well. I mean, this was something where he had to decide he wanted to play. They're giving him, I'm sure, an update on his status and telling him, you know, you're risking further injury. But it's up to the player when you get to Game 6, Game 7 of an NBA Finals. He only had to play 23 minutes in Game 6 because they fairly inexplicably blew out the Thunder. But to see it all happen, where for the third time we've seen it now in this postseason, where somebody kind of similarly is just making a basketball move, and you see the legs snap and that recoil. Remember it from Kevin Durant. It's what you see with quarterbacks, with Rodgers or Cousins or whatever. It's very obvious when you watch it in slow-mo and high def now.
Yep.
The Achilles goes. That was heartbreaking. I don't think I'm overstating that. Like, I don't remember being this crestfallen about a player that's not on my team.
Yeah.
Or a team dealing with an injury on a big stage that isn't mine. Because the Pacers were more fun to watch. They were a better story. I wasn't rooting against the Thunder necessarily because they're still fresh and it's a new cologne and they were so good this year. We'll give them their flowers in a second because that should be the story. But to your point, it really wasn't for me last night. The Pacers were on this legendary, this iconic run with the come-from-behind victories and stealing victories out of the jaws of defeat and Haliburton in the middle of it seemingly every single time. And I did find myself kind of going, man, would it be amazing if they did it one more time? And then he gets off to this ridiculous start to the game. And it was just really, really sad to see it end that way. But you're right. I just don't remember being that heartbroken for a player or a team. And somehow, by the way, that happened 8 minutes in. They led by a point without him at halftime.
Yep.
48-47. Like, they were doing the thing again where I'm going, there's no way,
they just
right?
keep hanging around, right?
Eventually, the Thunder proved to be too much.
And they thundered it, right? Where they forced a million turnovers. You look up and you go, oh my God, we're down 20. How did that happen? The last couple minutes, the whole thing's a blur, right? I mean, Oklahoma City was the best team because they can do that. Whatever gear that is, no one else in the league had that. And it wasn't like Oklahoma City did it once. They did this with one of the great turnover margins in the sports history. And that's their DNA, right? They're not always great in the half court. They're going to go through some ups and downs, like everyone else is subject to in a league about shooting threes and spacing people out. But it's that vice grip defense. It's the next guy, in this case, Cason Wallace, making unbelievable defensive effort after unbelievable defensive effort. And then Alex Caruso takes a turn. And then, you know, you forget about Dortz, who's, diving. I call him Dortz. Dortz is all over the place, elbowing people and shoving guys aside and diving for loose balls and just making every little hustle play to get their big guns more and more opportunities. They are awesome, and they deserve to be champions. Really, really cool for that young group of guys that's hopefully going to start something really, really neat. But I couldn't escape thinking about Haliburton. I mean, that run for Indiana was reminiscent of Villanova going on and beating Georgetown, reminiscent of NC State surviving in advance, reminiscent of some of the great Cinderella stories, USA Hockey. I mean, that they were underdogs everywhere and always. Every time they took the court, basically, they were underdogs, and they just kept punching back.
Well, I picked against them like 19 times in wins, right? It felt like, in the last month. I mean, they were the 4 seed, and it was a generational run led by Haliburton, who was hitting more big shots as the centerpiece than Robert Horry. And for the Achilles to go early in that game, it just felt like we were robbed of a classic.
Yeah.
Because in the first 7 or 8 minutes, it was, you know, a boxing match where they're standing in the middle of the ring, blow by blow, right. just landing
Rocky
punches.
And Apollo just taking turns, haymakers.
You knew in that game on that stage, like Halliburton's not going away. He's going to keep hitting shots. He's going to keep taking shots. And the only way he did end up going away was because the Achilles just gave on him. But I think it's important to point out for the Thunder as we dissect how they did this. This was about defense.
Yes.
You know, here we are in a market where the Wizards can't play defense, won't play defense, haven't in years. This Thunder team, for all of the talk about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander as an MVP and some of the firepower that they have, they forced 21 turnovers. This is what they've done all year long.
Mm-hmm.
They stole the basketball 14 times last night. They had a 32-10 edge off of turnovers in this game in scoring, plus 22, 32-10. And that's how they are built.
That's how they're doing
by the best GM of his era, probably, at this point. But they are built with harassing, pain-in-the-butt defenders. Alex Caruso, you mentioned Cason Wallace last night. Lou Dort, he'll hit threes. He gets credit for that, but like he is there to
bother you,
infuriate you for 36 minutes a night or whatever he's going to play. And then in the second half, to the Thunder's credit, because I kept saying, where is Chet Holmgren? I thought he had a terrible finals offensively. I know with his length, he defends the rim, and he's good on that end of the floor. But finally in the second half, they had 47 points at halftime.
Mm-hmm.
They're down a point to a Pacers team that spent the majority of the half without Tyrese Halliburton on the road in a Game 7 where your whole season's on the line. I couldn't really make sense of that except to say they needed more out of Williams, they needed more out of Holmgren, and they got it. They combined for 28 in the second half. Williams had 15, Holmgren had 13, and that was the biggest reason they went plus 14 in the third quarter. But I do think they won this championship because of their defense.
I do too. Pacers went small for a while when Halliburton went out. It was a lot of McConnell in the lineup. You know, Mathurin got big minutes too, but it was a lot of, you know, Nembhard, Nesmith, you know, and Oklahoma City couldn't really punish them. That, to your point, I'm going to the first half. If Chet Holmgren doesn't step up and do something, they're going to lose this game. Because Indiana's getting away with being small. And,
right.
and he's a full head taller than everyone else
but
on the court.
But didn't you think Chet played like that most of the finals?
A lot of it, yeah.
I kept waiting for the Chet game, the 25-27 point game.
And Pacers deserve some credit for that, for making him uncomfortable and not giving him, you know, some of those looks. But at some point, dude, come on, man.
So here's my Thunder question, or point, I guess, that I want to get a reaction to. First, I want to give them their flowers, because I don't think we've done that enough, as we've talked a lot about Halliburton and the Pacers. All-time season, we just saw.
Yeah.
68 wins to lead the NBA. Superstar guard wins the MVP in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Now you win your first title as an organization coming over to Oklahoma City. By the way, SGA, I thought last night, 16 in the first half, he was the only thing cooking. The only thing they had going is they scored 47 in that half. And then he finishes with a great line, 29-12-5, wins finals MVP. That was a foregone conclusion. He was not efficient. He missed a lot of shots. It really wasn't a good shooting night at all. I want to say he was like something like 6-for-28 from the floor, or whatever it was, or 8-for-28 or something.
Yeah, 8-for-27.
Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not a good shooting night, not efficient, but 29-12-5 every single time, please and thank you. They are great, and I believe this is the first of a few in this window. They're probably going to win 3 or 4. We've had 7 straight new champions. There's a parity in the NBA now that makes mm-hmm. it hard to go back-to-back, which I love. But you'd agree with me probably that this is the first of a few, because they've got a guy in Sam Presti running this thing as a GM, drafts better than anybody. The best GM, not only in the NBA.
Playing 3D chess,
I mean, he might be the best executive in sports right now. Like, that's what we're talking about. Is that fair?
Yeah, there's a conversation, sure.
He is a stud. But here is my hot take or whatever. I don't find watching their style aesthetically pleasing. Like, watching them in the playoffs as much as I did in watching the finals closely. See, I don't watch as much of them in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that fun to me. And what I mean by that, I know that it's kind of the new school NBA, but it's so much like iso ball. It's so much high pick and roll, and then mm-hmm. it's just a lot of SGA ball sticking, and I love him as a dude. I love him as a player. I'm not trying to knock him. But like when the Pacers have the ball, it looks different,
yes.
and it just looks better. I
uh-huh.
like it. The ball, there is no like alpha. The ball is constantly moving. They're getting these backdoor looks. It's just a prettier version of basketball, and so I don't even know if I have a big picture point here other than watching this, and it was a great finals, and it was memorable, and screw everyone who wants to talk about the TV numbers. I don't care about them. Give me more of these. But if this is going to be the team for the next 5 years in the NBA, I guess my point is it's going to be a little bit of work, because I just don't find them. Like, the Warriors were the most sexy thing to watch.
That's
ever.
What I was going to ask you, because it's like, you know, you think of those Spurs teams with Duncan. Obviously, he's the linchpin, but the ball's flying around. Everybody gets a chance. It's Everyone's going to get fat.
Yeah, and he's Mr. Fundamental, and it's supposedly he's Mr. Boring. There was nothing boring about those teams.
Right. Ginobili wasn't boring. Parker wasn't boring. Yeah, the way those guys are moving and cutting.
But
Golden
don't
State
you
was
agree?
The same
it's
way.
It's like the same thing. It's like high pick and roll, SGA. I don't know. There's the number has to exist. Some basketball guy could tell me. There's no way anybody has dribbled the basketball more this season than Gilgeous
The
Alexander.
Most dribbles per possession. Yeah, it's probably up there. I mean, yeah, I actually think it's a really savvy point by you. Thinking about how Denver did it, for example, when Jokic is right and healthy and they got all the pieces around him that, again, are right and healthy where it's him in the high post, it's him up top, it's him, kind of everywhere in between. If there's too much attention, the ball's, getting flung to the corner for a three for Porter Jr., or getting flung for an alley-oop to somebody. So, yeah, I it's not as much fun when a team is built on turning you over without pressing. It's not like Arkansas 40 minutes of hell style from back in the 90s. It's a half-court vice grip with a bunch of really excellent, limmy, long, or physically stout defenders in Dort's case. I think it's a really smart point. I mean, they basically were able to hide Gilgeous Alexander on defense because he's got so much offensive responsibility. Early on in this series, Indiana was getting a lot of things they wanted by basically saying, whoever he's got, that's who's going. So people are going, where's Halliburton? Why isn't he scoring a ton? Didn't matter because Nembhard's taking Gilgeous Alexander off the dribble. Then it was Nesmith's turn. I mean, everybody is going at that guy. They're able to kind of hide him defensively to make it so that it's iso ball on offense. I think you're right, but they remind me a bit, not exactly the same, but they remind me of those UConn teams recently here that won a couple back-to-back titles where you go, all right, we're in this. We're going punch for punch. It's not as if their offensive firepower is too much for us to deal with. They got guys hitting shots, and then you look up and you're down 12, and you go, what just happened? It's that defensive vice grip that takes away shot opportunities for you. That third quarter disparity, I think they missed more shots than Indiana took in the third quarter. It was close to that.
Well, yeah, because that's where a lot of the turnovers and happened, the steals were, for sure. The founder of Fanatics on the show a few weeks ago, actually, talking about what was going to be taking place at Fanatics Fest. Michael Rubin saying that they were spending an ungodly amount of money, basically, to make it the biggest party in the history of sports. Did you see any of the videos or coverage of what happened?
I did. What a spectacle. Kudos to those guys for figuring it out, right?
Tens of thousands of fans in lines to meet players and hundreds of the biggest names in sports and athletics and with different teams all showing up. I mean, it really was a Comic-Con kind of deal, but for sports, I would have loved to have been there, frankly. It was up in New York City, and maybe I'll go next year. It did seem like it was maybe a little even too crowded for my liking, but that having been said, there were just so many superstars there and panels, and it looked really, really cool. But I bring this up, Danny, because during the second night of Fanatics Fest over the weekend, Jaden Daniels, who was on site throughout the entire weekend, and Josh Harris, the owner of the Commanders, show up on stage with the CEO of Fanatics, Michael Rubin. And he grabs a mic and he asks, I don't really know what trade night is, but I think this was a big like memorabilia and cards portion of the event. And they had a bunch of people with some of the best cards on the market, essentially, that came together. And he asked who had the best, rarest Jaden Daniels card. And this guy named Josh Roth, who owned a Daniels one of one. I don't know a lot about cards, but I'm guessing it's the only one of its kind. That's what that means.
Or it's a DeSean Jackson.
Black finite prism card of Jaden Daniels, one of one. 2024 Panini Prism. I guess that's the type of card. And he's like, I've got the most rare Jaden Daniels card here. And so Ruben says, okay, well, how much will you sell it for? I got Josh Harris and Jaden Daniels right here. They want the card. And he initially said $2 million. And he tried to comp it to a Paul Skeens one of one that had just gone for $1.1 million during a Topps event that they'd had. It was a Topps Chrome Update MLB debut patch autograph card. So like Skeens' first game ever with a piece of his jersey and an autograph. Can you imagine pulling that card, by the way?
No, that seems pretty good.
And then it's appraised.
Hey, Mom, look at what I just got.
I don't know if it was appraised or sold, but it went for $1.1 million. And so this guy, Roth, says, the Jaden Daniels, I want $2 million. Like, well,
shoot your shot, dude. Love that.
I'm not so sure about that.
Like, it's like if Grant and Nanny are bidding, it's like, what do you guys give me? But like, you got the owner right there. Yeah.
The most recent appraisal he'd gotten was from the Reddit founder, who I guess said he'd be willing to pay $250,000 for it. Like, that's how much the card was worth to him, and he would pay. They grade these cards on like a 1 to 10 level. So a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are into cards right now. It's mm-hmm. gotten massive again. I'd love to get my little guy into it, and you know, we'll be casual with it, but I know a lot of people my age are suddenly like marks again for card collecting. It seems like an expensive hobby and a little bit like gambling, and I already do a lot of that and probably lose too much money as it is. So I'm not sure if that's the game I'm going to get heavy into. But this card was graded by Beckett. You remember Beckett?
Sure.
The book you thumb through to see what your card is worth. I get a Ryan Leaf. It's worth $300.75 from Spotsylvania Mall or whatever. Well, it's worth, apparently Beckett grades it as a 9.5 card out of 10. So 9 and above is like elite, no blemishes. 8, not great. Anything lower than that, you know, you get dinged a whole bunch. So I tell you all this to say that the owner of the Commanders, Josh Harris, then decides, I'll give you $500,000 for the thing right now. And he and Jaden Daniels agree. Daniels will sign a jersey for this guy, Josh Roth, and Harris is going to pay him $500,000 for this card. And they're then going to display this card at Northwest Stadium for all of you guys to see when you go out to the game. And so they strike this deal.
That's pretty amazing.
Right there in front of everyone at Fanatics Fest, the owner of the Commanders dropped $500,000.
On a decoration.
On a football card to display somewhere, I don't even know where, at the stadium. Just like that. Like, I go to the store and I'm like, you know what I want? I want a new grill. And I'm looking at Home Depot and it's like $350 and I'm like, I can't do this. Like, I really want a Traeger. Those things are like $800-$900. Those are super nice. That's out of the price range.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just getting a nubby. I'm just going to get a $300. I want charcoal and propane. I'm like, okay, probably can't do that. Josh Harris walks in and he's like, card, $500,000?
I'll take every grill you've ever had.
Just an amazing weekend for Josh Harris scooping up the Jaden Daniels card.
That's
what do you
think?
That's so wild.
I think it's so neat. Now, some are just going to roll their eyes. You're like, oh, what a waste of money or whatever. But, I mean, to me, the whole point of it was, it's a celebration of Jaden Daniels. You're not buying like a Todd Rutledge card or something like that, you know, like some backup number. You're buying like a superstar.
Well, wasn't he just kind of also being a showman at the event?
That's part of it.
Part of it was like.
Yeah. But it's also that it's not going to hide away in some, you know, locked office somewhere, like in some safe. This is a display for all of us. The whole point is like you're enhancing our shared experience. And the thing that I've admired the most about Harris and Rails and Ein and Magic Johnson and company that, you know, have gotten this thing, they understand that they own it. Of course they do. You spent an outrageous amount of money. It took all the money and everybody pulling together every bit of liquid they had to get this thing done, to get it over the finish line. I saw that. But they also get that it's our thing. I know I don't own it. I'm very aware. I got no receipts. I got no deposits. I've never like paid any money towards a fraction of ownership. I don't have any of those Green Bay Packers stupid pieces of paper that when they need some cash. But these guys understand that this is part of this big public trust. And they're caretakers. They own it, and they know that. But there's a sharing with us, and we all get to partake in it to a degree that they're kind of embracing, and that's another example of that to me. That's the first thing I thought of.
I think that's actually a really good point. And I think this is symbolic. It's a good observation of what they talk about all the time, that there is some fiduciary responsibility that they have with the fan base, with the city, and they really do view this as, you know, an obligation that they have to return this thing to the form it once had, but also just to do right by the fan base. And so in their minds, I mean, think about the I don't know if you guys saw this, but like Jaden Daniels, there were thousands of Commanders fans there. And maybe they're not even Commanders fans. Maybe they're just other market Jaden Daniels fans. But the amount of Commanders 5 jerseys that were around the stage for the events that he took part in was astounding to me. He was one of the more popular events at the, you know, guys at the event. And I think in their minds, they're going, let's give people a chance to really celebrate Jaden by having this card on display for them. Let's go to Brandon, who's in Warrington on G&D. What's up, Brandon?
How we doing, gents?
Hey, dude.
Doing well.
So I'm actually one of the few people in the world that owns a Jaden Daniels 1-of-1.
Oh, you have a 1-of-1 Daniels card?
I do.
Wow.
I pulled it in a single pack that I bought from Panini. So I was actually at Fanatic Fest as well.
Can
so
I have
saw
the
that
card?
Whole thing go down. Can you have the card? Yeah, you can see it. Sure.
You can't touch it with your hands,
do you,
though.
Do you have any idea? Yeah. Have you gotten it appraised or like the Beckett or somebody look at it for the quality yet?
So I have. I sent it off to PSA, which is typically the gold standard along with Beckett. And I actually graded a gem. It graded a perfect 10.
No way. Dude.
Yes. So PSA charged me for the $25,000 evaluation level. So I'm right around the $25,000 to $45,000.
So you buy a pack for, you know, maybe 10 to 50 bucks, depending on how many cards you got or whatever. The correct. Greatest investment of all time, you pull this card and it's worth $25,000.
Yes. In one word. Yes.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah, so what's so special? What kind
of
card is it?
There's a ton of luck.
Of course.
Of course, Tony.
Panini Donruss Optic. Panini Prism is the one that Roth had, and that's like the gold standard product. Everybody loves Prism. That was the first one that Panini came out with back in 2012, I think.
But, I mean, is there a special? Did he autograph it? Is there a part of a jersey on it, or is it just a normal card? So
that's another thing that you get into. Panini is actually losing their licensing. Topps is picking all of that up, Fanatics. And Jaden Daniels is an exclusive with Topps and Fanatics. So he does not sign for Panini. That is actually a non-signed card. It's just a one of one.
Wow.
But it's still just as desirable as one with his ink on it.
Good nuggets. By the way, Brandon knows what he's talking about when it comes to cards. That guy's got a one of one card worth 25 G's.
That's pretty neat.
I get sized for that.
But can you imagine sending that off somewhere? Just like, oh, just put it in the mail. Like, I would be so nervous
to
stuff that in an envelope or whatever.
My buddy pulled a one of one Caitlin Clark that he thought was going to be worth $30,000. He sent it off. They appraised it as like a. Basically, a 7.
I'm glad you have it.
They said it was an issue. And he's like, no. And they show him this mark. And he's like, that mark wasn't there when it went to you guys. You know, so it's a whole big ordeal now.
Oh, my God.
By the way, Darius, grab that guy's info. Let him know. I'll give him my address. And he could just ship the card over to me. I don't think he understood when I'd asked. I wanted the card, not to see it.
Yeah.
I don't think he got that.
He got confused. You could tell him I have a 20 in my wallet.
20 bucks.
I have $20.
That should do it. The Wizards, ahead of tomorrow's draft, are actually swinging a trade right now, and this is a massive development into 106.7 The Fan. So let's get this breaking news to you right now via Toby Altizer.
Massive trade for the Washington Wizards ahead of tomorrow's NBA draft. Jordan Poole on the move to the New Orleans Pelicans. He joins Sadiq Bey in the number 40 overall pick. Going to the New Orleans Pelicans, coming back to the Washington Wizards is C.J. McCollum, Kelly Olynyk, and a future second-round pick. Again, the Wizards trading Jordan Poole, Sadiq Bey, and the number 40 pick to the New Orleans Pelicans. The Wizards getting back C.J. McCollum, Kelly Olynyk, and a future second-round pick. I'm Toby Altizer with breaking news on The Fan.
Jordan Poole traded by the Wizards.
Whoa.
Poole, who's got a four-year, $123 million contract. He is set to make $31.8 million against the cap this year and $34 million against the cap next year. Not a free agent until two more seasons from now. Is on the move, so the Wizards get out of that money, and they bring in C.J. McCollum, who is a veteran and one of the true good guys in the NBA. Kelly Olynyk, who when I hear his name, I think about the back-breaking performance he delivered to beat Washington.
Yeah.
With the Boston Celtics in Game 7 on the verge of the Eastern Conference Finals, going back to the Beal Wall days. So Kelly Olynyk coming to D.C., and a future second-round pick, Danny Jordan Poole, Sadiq Bey, and pick number 40 from Washington in New Orleans.
Okay, so just reading through this really, really quickly. McCollum, I believe, is on an expiring deal or close to it. So I think that's what this is about more than anything else. You're rearranging deck chairs there. Poole, more dynamic. A bit more exciting, a bit more mercurial. McCollum, steady Eddie, really nice player, good veteran, a solid, solid piece. But I think he's entering the last year of a $63 million plus deal that he's owed. So just over $30 million bucks, and then the added pieces in there to kind of make that the salary work right there. So to me, that's what this looks like. It looks like a shortening of a commitment to a high level guard, right? Or to a guy that's going to share, that's going to have a lot of usage as a guard, right? So Poole, they was under contract for multiple seasons. And is going to dominate the basketball. They found he was much better with the ball in his hands, moving him off the ball, letting Kuzma create 2 years ago. Didn't really work particularly well for him. Moving him back to point guard, putting him in the starting lineup. He played pretty well, to his credit, and bought in and was a good citizen. Less so the unserious player that he was for a time where he's not in timeouts, not listening, sort of, you know, acting buffoonishly. Locked in much better last year. But this, to me, is about shortening the window of salary. And I wonder if it's a precursor to you for who they might be looking at tomorrow.
Well, I would say that somebody who's going to have the ball in his hands and can shoot, you know, a guard who can fill it up from outside, like a Trey Johnson who we were just talking about, makes even more sense now, right? Because just from a sheer quantity of shots available standpoint, Poole leaving's a big, big deal, right? Nobody is more ball dominant when he's on the floor and kind of demands, maybe not verbally, but by way of how he plays, more looks and more shots. You mentioned Kelly Olynyk. It's a two-year deal, $26 million for him, an average of about 13 mil per. But you're bringing in expiring contracts. You got out of 2 years of Poole. He makes $31 million, which is about even, by the way,
with McCollum,
with what C.J. McCollum makes. Mm-hmm. He makes 30.6, but his deal ends this year. So you now go into next offseason with $30 million more in flexibility and ability to spend, and then you bring in Olynyk as well. Say, this reminds me a little bit of Marcus Smart, where they go get these veterans and everyone's going, this doesn't seem like you're tanking. What is the point of this? Well, everything in the NBA is about flexibility and getting out of contracts, right? So whereas Jordan Poole, much younger than McCollum, had 1 year left on the deal, now at age 34, C.J. McCollum, who by my understanding on the outside looking in has long been considered one of the better locker room guys in the NBA anyway, you bring him in here for his maiden voyage, assuming he's on the team all year, and he plays at that rate. Olynyk, by the way, is going into what is the final year of his two-year deal.
Mm-hmm.
So both of these deals come off the books, huge flexibility at the end of this year. The reaction is going to be, who does this benefit? This is the most NBA thing ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just rearranging
everybody's
money, basically,
different. Yeah, everyone's in different places for it. So Chris Middleton opts in to his player option, I believe, at $33 million, which is steep. But again, that's the last year for him. Last year now for McCollum. Last year for Olynyk. It tells you, like, if you ever see somebody gear up for that high jump at the NFL Combine or that broad jump, this is your gearing down, bending your knees, that butt's just off the ground, and you're getting ready to do a watch what we do next offseason. That's what these moves, rearranging some of the contracts and furniture, looks like to me. It's a, we want to have every resource available, dollar, draft pick, whatever, to have the ultimate flexibility next year. That's what this looks like to me.
Wizards fans, we were teeing you up to talk draft tomorrow. You still can. But more timely now, what a trade. On the move, Jordan Poole out. You've got veterans in C.J. McCollum and Kelly Olynyk coming back. You know what it means when you hear this song on our show. We were having a little Austin Ekeler withdrawal, and here in the offseason, he was kind enough to check in with his boys to see how things were going. Austin's actually got something really cool coming up, by the way, as well. The Austin Ekeler Foundation's announcing a 2025 charity football fantasy league sign-up. This year, they got a bunch more NFL legends, bunch of players participating, including Geno Smith, A.J. Dillon, Jamal Williams, Brian Dawkins, Ray Lewis. Every participant in Austin's fantasy leagues is going to receive a signed item. They can win prizes including signed gear, game-worn memorabilia, and tickets, championship rings, so much more. See the full list of participants right now at charitydraft.com/NFL-league. But Austin is with us to talk more about this and everything going on in his life this offseason. It has been too long, man. How you been?
What's going on, boys? Got to say, I know you guys have built a great community out there, and I know that because I've been around town a little bit. People are like, hey, I hear you on the Grant and Danny show. And I'm like, man, those guys got it going on. So good work to you guys, but good to see you back.
Yeah, buddy. This is such a cool thing that you're doing. You've always had like great ideas and thoughts about something, and you're always thinking in kind of that 360 panoramic. How did this, you know, charity fantasy football thing come about? I think it's such a cool idea.
Yeah, you know, people are passionate about fantasy football, and I'm like, I love that. I love that part of it. And I was like, how can I maybe add to that, but also use it in a way that gives back to the community? And so one year I put up like some game tickets, a game jersey, and a championship ring for people to win. And we had a bunch of people trying to get in. I was like, okay, we might be onto something here. And we've grown ever since then. And so now we do charity fantasy football leagues for kind of like the My Cause, My Cleats of the NFL. Kind of now we do it with fantasy football. So people can, like Ray Lewis has his own foundation that you can go win some signed gear, you know, VIP tickets and stuff like that from his foundation. But then also the money goes to a good cause.
Austin Eckler, it's the Austin Eckler Foundation expanding his initiative, including over 20 athletes for the 2025 season in his fantasy football leagues this year for the foundation. His largest annual fundraiser, by the way, they raised more than $80,000 to date, and 100% of that supports the foundation's mission to deliver tangible resources to underserved communities. So job well done by Austin Eckler. And one of the cool things about you, even before you came to D.C., one of the things that I really was enamored with you for over the years, in addition to the fact that you won me fantasy championships when you were with the Chargers, was how into fantasy football you are and were. And I know that hasn't really changed, but I like that you've parlayed your interest into this as well. You don't hear many guys, they kind of shy away from talking fantasy, that are into it, but it seems like it's still a big part of your football fandom.
Yeah, and I'll give a little story of how I even got into fantasy. It was actually my third year in the NFL. And this is a year where I had, I think, right under 1,000 yards receiving, had like 11 touchdowns, and was pretty just active in the offense. This is like my first year really just being a kind of like a split carry type back. And it was a year where all of a sudden after the season, like I was like the sleeper of the year, because the year before I was mainly like a half special teams guy and then kind of like a backup third string type guy. And so out of nowhere, there's hundreds of people just thank you for winning my fantasy. And I started to realize kind of the magnitude of this fantasy football thing. And I thought it was super cool how people from other teams would be a fan of me because I was on their fantasy team. And I thought that was really special for the league. And I thought that was really cool to see different people from across the world, not even U.S., like I said, across the world, that are like, hey, man, thank you. And so I thought it was really cool. And I love the community aspect that it brings. So again, going back to charitydraft.com, that's exactly what we're trying to do there. There's a lot of guys, like we have, you know, Tyler Biadasz, he's our center, right? He doesn't have probably any really true effect directly on fantasy football, but he has a lot of fans out there from all over the place that probably play fantasy football. So this is an awesome way and another example of how fantasy can bring us together and hopefully can get some good out of fantasy from a fan and athlete standpoint. Because, you know, athletes, we don't really tune into it a lot because a lot of it's a lot of toxicity. So hopefully this is a way to give a better kind of outlook on the fantasy space.
Austin Eckler with us here on Grant and Danny. Austin, I heard you on the Ross Tucker podcast. I thought you were awesome, engaging, and just, you know, really cool and thoughtful as always. And one of the
questions... Is Austin seeing other radio shows? Is he seeing other broadcasters?
Oh, no.
That's what I was going to ask you about. Ross is a nice guy. I think we like him, but what the hell?
That's our boy.
Yeah, no,
we'll allow that one. Yeah. But he's the best.
So I'm just basically ripping this off of him in that conversation you guys had. I thought you gave such a cool answer about his question about closing the gap with Philadelphia. They're the Super Bowl champs. They were really, really good. You guys played them tough multiple times throughout last year. And I thought you gave such a brilliant answer on that. So at the risk of doubling up here, can you rehash that, what you said to Ross, to us, just thinking about how teams are formed and kind of where we're at right now and about, quote, unquote, closing that gap with Philadelphia?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's from an outside perspective, there's maybe a gap that still exists in football because everyone's like, oh, that's what they did last year. Because as a fan and as analysts, like, it's all about what have you done for me lately? Like, what have you done lately? Well, obviously, Philadelphia had an awesome run and they won the Super Bowl and all of that stuff. Well, now it's a reset. And you could take us, you know, last year, for example, you know, at the beginning of the season, people would have said there was a massive gap between the Washington Commanders and having any chance to make to the playoffs because of the season before. But clearly that wasn't the case. We came out, we had a new philosophy, we had a new coaches, new culture, new players, and we put something together that was able to, you know, give us a run and push us deep into the playoffs. So it's a new reset. And so when I hear people talk about the gap, I get it, because, you know, we got to talk about stuff, people, keep people entertained. But for us as players, there is no gap, right? You create the gap, you know, in your offseason training, moving into preseason, into season. It's creating that new gap again. Yes, you have expectations, but that doesn't mean anything when we actually put on the pads and start playing football, because things happen. People play better than expected. People play worse than expected. Sometimes there's injuries. So it's all about recreating the gap and reestablishing yourself as a dominant team. And I know we got a lot of players coming back, and I'm looking forward to, you know, continuing to push so we can be hopefully the narrative of, oh, the gap between us and other teams.
Austin, we can get into the Commanders in more detail in a moment, but one of the things I've been wondering for your thoughts on, we just haven't chatted with you in a while, this offseason is, I remember sometime last year talking about the running back position, and you were very opinionated about basically the devaluation of it and how you thought it was going to come back in a big way. And it's pretty amazing that it did, I don't want to say quickly because it's been a few years, but last year, if you look at the number of 1,000-yard backs compared to like 2, 3, 4 years ago, I mean, it skyrocketed. We had two guys flirt with 2,000 yards in Barkley and Derrick Henry carrying their teams deep to the playoffs. We saw Ashton Jeanty, who maybe should have won the Heisman, could have won the Heisman, but, you know, was a top-of-the-board draft pick this year. And it seems like with teams kind of playing two deep safeties, trying to not teams take let teams take the lid off, you know, playing that, like, anti-Chiefs defense that spread throughout the league, the run game became in vogue again with lighter boxes. Curious to get your thoughts on that and how you think that changes kind of the health of the pay scale at the position, because it all changed within the last couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are different trends, absolutely, when it comes to philosophies. And, you know, I think there was a few years where we've seen a lot of zero blitz from a few teams, and we still see that from some. Now we're seeing a lot of too high because, all right, as a defense, what do you have to do? You have to make sure that you limit the big plays, because more big plays that you have against you, the more less likely it is for you to score. So if you have a team that has a four-yard drive and a touchdown, that's bad. But if they have a 14-yard drive and a touchdown, you'll take that, because the likelihood of them being able to do that again, 14 yards and a touchdown, is not very high, because eventually someone's going to make a mistake on offense, right? That's what you're banking on. Hey, we're going to be able to bend, not break mentality, at least hold them to a field goal. So I definitely can see a trend of, you know, hey, we're paying a lot of money to these guys to go down the field and make big plays. So let's stop these guys. How do we stop these guys from going down, all these receivers? So guess what? We're going to put some more help back there. So as runners, I mean, you still have to be a dynamic player. Now, I'm not saying everyone can go out there and run for 1,000. That's definitely not easy. But if you're a playmaker, and which we saw a lot of last year, right, you're going to have more opportunities than maybe in the past than you have. And when it comes to the pay, you know, here's what I want to see. If you are an impact player on the team, regardless of position, I think you should see some new money coming into that position. And it had been a while since the running backs were, you know, seeing any new money coming in as far as setting new kind of all-time highs. So I think there was just a lull in our market for a little bit. But again, we were able to kind of establish that we have playmakers in our market. And I know Saquon kind of set the new bar, but that's my philosophy when it comes to, you know, the new running kind of opportunities that might be open up with these defenses trying to, hey, exactly like you said, stop the deep ball and make these guys drive all the way down the field, play by play.
Austin Eckler with us here on G&D. And Austin, you know, going back to last year for you, obviously, you know how we feel here on this radio program. We're Austin Eckler. Guys, you're so good with the ball in your hands. And, you know, you make things easy at times, right, where just a little, you know, dump off to you is a first down and the chains move and we get a new set. And, you know, it's so effective, obviously, when you've got the football. What do you want to do this year where you go, you know what, I want to keep doing that? And then looking back at last year, do you go, you know what, I want to do a little bit better in this area? So something you want to keep going with and something you say, you know what, I want to tick that up a little bit.
Yeah, for me, it's always be efficient. And, you know, my role has changed over the years for sure. Now going back to kind of that split back that I used to have in my first 3 years. And so for me at this point, I know with our philosophy, we have Brian Robinson back there who is a big body who, you know, is more of a downhill runner. And so then you have myself who's more, you know, of an elusive type back and catch the ball in the backfield. So there's going to be a complementary type of role in both of us for each other. So for me, it's continue to stay efficient. I actually had like one of my most efficient years Last year, I know I missed some games for some concussions, but, you know, I was right there under 5 yards a carry and over 10 yards a carry yep. on the reception. So, like, that's where I love to be, and I know I'm efficient when I'm at those numbers. And so, again, what do I want this year? Want the same. Where do I want to get better? It's some things that we can't always control, which is the injuries. I want to definitely see myself get through the entire season. I know it's a violent, you know, combat sport, so sometimes you just take a hit, you know, and you don't get up from it, unfortunately. And so my thing is continue to make sure that my brain is right, continue that I'm healthy, be available, especially even in the return game. You know, that was something that was asked of me that I haven't done since my rookie year. So I just want to continue to be effective there and just try to make the biggest impact on whatever my role is. Because, you know, we have a competitive backfield right now. We have 8 running backs in the room. So, you know, looking at last year, we played a lot of guys. There was a lot of guys that rotated. I think we played like 4 or 5 running backs last year. And so I know that's probably going to be something that is going to happen again this year, depending on the situations and things like that. But again, whatever my role is, continue to stay the most efficient I possibly can, which is just building off what I did last year.
Yeah, your efficiency was essentially back to your year three area, right around 23, 24 years old, averaging about 5 yards per attempt. And as you said, 10.5 per catch. And people forget you ripped off the first return of the season in the home opener. Got called back for a penalty, but some huge plays on special teams as well. I don't always like asking guys to speak for other players, but just because you're around him and you've kind of seen his demeanor, you know, so much of this offseason around here, and I'll raise my hand, I guess I'm part of the problem. You know, a lot of us were longing for maybe someone to pair with you at the running back position that might be able to provide a little bit more of a home run ability or speed to go with you. And it's not that anybody's down on B-Rob, but I think he's taking it that way. And some social media stuff about how hard he's working and he hears the noise and whatnot. Just your thoughts on him going into the season. It's a big year for him personally, obviously for the team. They need him to shine. And just his demeanor as you've seen him this offseason getting to work.
Yeah, absolutely. My man is definitely fired up, as fired up as he can possibly be. He's got a big year for him. We've talked about it. He knows this, not only because, you know, it's the year that he's in, but because it's contract year. Like, as NFL players, we already have the utmost pressure on us. And a lot of that is put on by ourselves because we have a standard for ourselves that we want to play to the highest and not just compete, but win, right? And so when you have that type of mentality, you know, you have to deal with that because there's the pressure of the media of maybe, hey, maybe you're not playing or where you want to be. But my man right now is juiced, jacked up, healthy, ready to go. So I'm excited for B-Rob to have a big year.
Can you go into the expectations that kind of come on with the season you guys had last year? I know you were there in L.A. for a while when, you know, you guys started to get pretty good. You know, I think you got a 12-win season in the mix while you were there. And all of a sudden, the expectations become, hey, this is now one of the elite teams in the NFL, and kind of dealing with that. Maybe the target on your back, that to use a terrible cliche that everyone always talks about. But what's it going to be like to deal with some of the expectations you guys have this year after that unbelievable year last year?
Yeah, you know, I think when you look at this year coming up, I think one thing that's really going to help us is Dan Quinn's philosophies. DQ does not let us look past one day. We will come into the team meeting and he'll say, hey, I got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I got all that scheduled out. Trust me, that day will come. I need you right here on Monday. Like, this is where I need you right here, right now. And he is all about in the moment, the brotherhood at the time, the energy that we need at that moment. If it's a practice, if it's a walkthrough, we need the walkthrough type energy. If it's game day, hey, we got to be in the game day, you know, type, you know, energy. So for him, he's always making sure that he keeps the team where we should be. And that helps us manage our expectations because our expectations are to continue to be the best that we can in that moment for what that moment is. And so for us, you know, there wasn't a lot of expectation from the outside noise. Now there is. But for us, it's no different because we're not looking outside. We're looking at one day at a time. And I really appreciate Dan Quinn and how much he really preaches that to us because it's definitely going to help us because I know there's definitely going to be a lot of noise about, hey, what we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to be. But for us, none of that matters because we got to take it day to day to even get to some of these expectations that people are expecting from us.
Austin Eckler, again, the new venture he's got, and he's ramping it up this year, is the Eckler Foundation 2025 Charity Fantasy Football Leagues. They've got more NFL players and more NFL legends than ever before partaking. There's all kinds of great things that you can win, so you'll want to check that out at Austin's website and at the Austin Eckler Foundation's site. Last one for me. I'm taking on some heat for this today, no pun intended, but I want to see where you come in. I don't want to lead the witness. The Four Seasons, ranked by Austin Eckler, 1-4, favorite to least favorite, your ranking of the seasons would be what?
Of just like summer, winter, fall seasons or what?
Yeah.
Well, sorry. Yeah, not sports. Yeah. Fall, spring, not winter, summer.
We got to want to switch up there, man. You got to like set me up a little bit. You know, we're talking four seasons, the hotel. We're talking four seasons, you know.
We don't get to stay in those as often. No,
the Motown band, right? Okay. The Four Seasons, yeah.
My long time take has been that summer's the worst season. It's probably because I'm a bigger fella. I think it's terrible and overrated. So I've got fall, spring, winter, summer in that order. What is your ranking of seasons?
Okay. Ranking of season. I'm going to say spring. I love spring as number one because it's kind of cooler. Things are growing. You know, you're just coming out of winter and it's like, all right, like this is kind of like the new fresh start. Fall is probably number two because that's when, you know, for the past 21 years of my life, I have strapped it up and played football, not missed a season, knock on wood. So that's number two. I'll say summer is number three. A lot of some good times in the summer, kind of like a reset type of time. And then I hate the cold. That's why I live on the West Coast. So I'll say winter is last.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, Danny, I think it's just that, you know, we don't like being outside and sweating. That's got to be what it
is. Yeah, but in shape guys, like, oh, my shirt fell off again. Look at all my abs. Like, I get that, Austin. I get that from you.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing. Right. But I said spring. Summer's third for me, so it's not too far off.
I love spring. It's also pretty good.
Also wanted to throw this in there because I know maybe it got messed up in the brief. But, yeah, it's charitydraft.com is where you can see all of our stuff that we're doing this year with all the fantasy leagues. So if you want to win some awesome prizes, like for example, if you make it to the playoffs in one of my tiers, you get tickets to Commanders Eagles, right? So home game week 15. So definitely check it out, charitydraft.com. Go see what's going on over there. See all the awesome prizes and all the causes that are being affected by all this.
So cool. Awesome. Great to catch up with you, man. Stay healthy.
Likewise.
We'll talk to you soon, buddy. Thank you.
Sounds good. Yep. See you guys.
See you, bud.
There's our guy, Austin Eckler. You heard him all season long on Grant and Danny. You see why we love having him on The Fan. Trey Johnson is a Washington Wizard at number 6. The board fell exactly how I wanted it to. Now, the only thing that would have been more effective for the Wizards is if Ace Bailey was also there, because then the grown-ups in the room, Will Dawkins and company, would have been able to choose between the two really ideal options for them, probably from a skill standpoint, and in my opinion, two of the best scorers in this class when it's all said and done. And I just think that your chances of not only getting it right but hitting a home run probably go up. When you get to choose between the two, we would know. Do they really want Ace Bailey or do they really want Trey Johnson? That would have just
would have found some stuff out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Better scenario. The fact that only one was available, I think, made it probably pretty easy. And now we'll never know. Would they have taken Bailey over Johnson? I mean, wouldn't it have been interesting if they were both there and they still went Trey Johnson? You'd know how much they loved the kid. But I want scores. Mike Singletary once said, I want winners. I want winners. Well, I want scorers. I want people that can take you off the dribble, that can hit set shots, that can create their own offense. And the Wizards got themselves a guy who, as a freshman in the best conference in America, averaged 20 points a game. It's hard to go wrong when you get someone who can get you a bucket. And they did last night at number 6 overall with Trey Johnson.
With the 6th pick in the 2025 NBA Draft, the Washington Wizards select Trey Johnson from the University of Texas.
Fist pumped in the house. Now, he was wearing a horrific outfit. White socks up to his knees that were very puffy and, like, scrunched up.
I'm going to look right past that.
Black shoes, shorts with his suit.
Yeah.
right away I thought, oh boy, this is my guy. This is the one. This is who I'm standing on the table for the last week. It's okay. He can hoop. He can score buckets. I'm going to be okay with the socks and the
shoes. He's half your age. It's got more and more. It's going to happen as you get older.
That is a really good point. Literally, what is he, 19?
Yeah.
We're 1 year away from these guys being half my age.
Yeah. It's a rude awakening when it happens. Okay. Quick rant. I'm surprised they got the audio of that. They got back from commercial in time. At some point, please acknowledge the basketball team that's in your league is in your league. Just make something up. Give me 30 seconds. Even if it's Stephen A. shouting about they're building a nice young core there or they're in the stockpiling assets game. Say something about the basketball team. Just pretend. It's good for the league. We just saw the playoffs happen where two teams that had never done it before got a chance to do it.
Still waiting on our first take on the construction of the current Wizards roster. Malika Andrews was the host last night. Occasionally as a host, you and I do that on the radio here. Our producer will get in our ear and tell us something. So, like, right before we played that clip, Darius got in my ear, and he said, hey, I got the audio of last night's pick. And then I knew, okay, we're ready to play the audio. Here's what it sounded like last night every time the Wizards were on the clock.
Hey, Malik, the Wizards are on the clock here, so let's get to a quick break, and we'll come back and announce the pick, and then we'll move on with the rest of our show. Hey, Malika, remember, the Wizards are on the clock here, so let's make sure we take a quick break. Hey, Malika, I know it says the Jazz, but this is actually the Wizards' pick, so let's make sure, even though the Jazz are on the clock, that we take a break and don't talk about the Wizards.
Three separate times a Wizards-affiliated thing happened. Three separate times they went to commercial. I'm sorry to the network execs that the Knicks weren't in it so they could opine before, after, during, 10 times after the fact that a franchise that hadn't been relevant in decades finally was this year, by the way. Congrats to everybody involved. So they could wax poetic about LeBron's hairline or whatever the hell's going on in LA. Just at some point. I understand I'm not a marquee franchise. I get it. I haven't deserved it. No 50-win seasons in my lifetime. It's been 45 years since they won 50 games. I get it, man. I get it. Just a little bit. Just
how long
a little
ago was 1978?
Plenty of time.
Last championship?
Yeah.
Look at some of those highlights, those grainy highlights with the 1970s parade and
high
celebration.
Shorts, a lot of three-man weave, a lot of set shots. All good, man. Totally fine. I get we haven't done much to deserve a lot of credit. They're working on it. I actually believe in this front office. But damn it if that's not frustrating. Beyond that, it's ridiculous, if I can be frank. Again, I'm not asking for more airtime than the champions. I want Oklahoma City to get their flowers. They deserve it. They're built well. A couple years ago, though, they were us. They're winning 20-some games. They sucked. Show me a comparison. Dawkins came from this front office. Look at what they're doing. It's kind of similar to OKC did. Now, where's their SGA trade? Great question, Stephen A. Let's go to a guy that made a million trades right over here at the front office executive. Whatever. Just so easy to do, and they have no interest in doing it. At a certain point, it's partly their fault why nobody considers us a serious destination. Back to the pick itself. Thrilled with this. This kid is here to score on your ass. Great shooter. Right now, catch and shoot. Yes. Off the dribble, pretty good. Probably 7.5, 8 out of 10 in that range. 9 out of 10 as a catch and shoot
guy. He'll get better.
I don't see him as an around-the-rim finisher yet. I think he will be. I think there's too much arm length. I think there's too much grit in the kid. I think he loves scoring on people. He gets his shot off against anyone and everyone every time, always. It's floaters, it's off angles, it's off rhythm, it's in between stuff, it's that herky-jerky. He can score on anyone. He'll get stronger. I believe he better finish around the rim. I think as he gets into the league a little bit and has the ball in his hands, I think he'll grow as a playmaker. I could see initiating offense through him. I could see him in pick and roll, pick and pop situations. I could see him averaging 4.5, 5 assists a game as he kind of goes through his career. You know what he reminds me of? Devin Booker. That's the kind of scorer I think he is. I think right now he walks into onto a bad team, is going to score 18 to 20 points per game, and I think it's going to grow from there. This kid is good.
Yeah, I mean, that's the number one comp that everybody throws on him. I've also heard Donovan Mitchell. But Devin Booker, Trey Johnson, that's kind of any comparison on any site that is getting thrown on him for upside, that's what it looks like. He's going to be able to score in the NBA where they don't play defense. I think he's going to score a lot. And now your backcourt moving forward is your developmental point guard, Bub Carrington, who with Jordan Poole traded to New Orleans is going to get a lot of minutes at the one, and a two who can get his shot up. So this is exciting and this is fun, and I'm jacked up to watch him play and maybe even get out to a couple of games this year to see him go get baskets because I think he's going to be able to do that. They had the 18th pick as well. And in the same way that last year, while getting Saar at 2 was a big deal, the draft kind of revolved around what they did after that when they went up to get Bub Carrington. And this has kind of been the philosophy. They went up to get Koulibaly. We thought maybe they would package some of their billions of assets together and come up the board a little bit from 18 to get a guy they really liked. And they actually ended up doing the opposite. The board didn't fall maybe in a way that they loved. So at 18, with a couple of players that were intriguing, they weren't smitten, and they moved back three spots. They got a pick tonight, and they got two future second-round picks. Mm-hmm. So they are now up to, I believe it's more than 15. It might be 16 second-round picks over the next 7 years that they have. And second-round picks almost rarely, as the player chosen, end up being a star. Everyone will point to Nikola Jokic, who got drafted during a Taco Bell commercial in round two, and some other names like that. That it does happen. Gilbert Arenas or some other guys. But what mostly happens is those picks are assets that you package together in trades. So when they want to go get their superstar in a year or two, you can throw six number twos into that deal or whatever. And those assets for that team have value because then they have that to use on the trade they want to eventually do. So they pick up three picks, go back three spots, and then they take Will Riley out of Illinois. And we'll talk to his head basketball coach this past year in college, Brad Underwood, coming up in 45 minutes at 3 o'clock. But you know, Riley is a wing. He's a bit of a slasher. He came on as an offensive player last year. And there'll be a debate as to should they have taken someone else. I don't know anything. The guy that I liked there was Asnuel. Mm-hmm. There were other options, right? I just like when I watched literally basically the Eric Bickle draft breakdown. When I'm like watching these guys and reading about them, you kind of fall for different players. And he was the guy on the clock there that I liked. They know a lot more. I will defer to them. It wasn't a guard, which is the one thing maybe at that point that wouldn't have made sense. So they go get a wing where they got a bunch of bodies as well, and they'll have to work him into the fold. But overall last night, if they were going to come out of the evening with Trey Johnson, I was going to love it. And if they were going to come out of the evening with Ace Bailey, who got picked one pick before them, I would have liked it. Anything else at six might have been disappointing.
Yep.
I'm elated by last night. Really, it almost doesn't matter what they did. The pick at 21, moving back and getting assets, that's got them written all over it, and hopefully they're right about Riley like they were on Bilal and some of these other guys. I'll take their word for it. Can't argue with them over the pick. I don't know enough. But the Trey Johnson pick, to me, is a victory for this fan base.
Yeah, that should be the takeaway. I was left with a whelmed taste in my mouth at the end of the evening with the Riley selection. Only started 7 or 8 games, I think, for Illinois. Down the stretch, played better as he went. But this is their type. If you got a box of checklists, right, or a checklist box, and you start checking off things. Are you tall for a wing position? Are you long for a wing position? Are you athletic? Yes. Do you have a decent motor? Yes. All of a sudden, it becomes somebody that they're into. This is a little bit more of a project, I think, which is fine, just given their timetable. But I think there are guys that could have come in and played well right away. And again, I saw him a handful of times at Illinois. I like this teammate a lot better than went to Miami a couple picks before, Yakushonis, who I think is kind of perfectly settled for this modern day NBA.
It's probably why he went before that. Yeah, a lot of people probably liked him.
And the Heat went, oh, thank you for not taking him. And they, you know, sprinted to the podium to do so. So there are a couple guys there that I liked better as players, but you said it very well. This front office has earned my trust. They know more than I do.
Especially in the draft.
Yeah.
Like whether this works or not, the process that we're undergoing here, mm-hmm. this tank, this rebuild, whatever. And people still take issue with it. I'm arguing with people last night during the draft on social media. My point is, you did it your way for a long time. What did it get you?
Yeah.
You want to not do this? You want to do it the other way? I wonder if they could win that way. It's only been 50 years of trying.
I got a pretty good sample that says no. I mean, for example, Walter Clayton Jr., who they quote-unquote took at 18. We still have to do that illusion, by the way.
Whatever, well, that's the worst thing about this draft.
Yeah, whatever rule.
What a dumb thing. Why is that a thing? The broadcasters can't keep it straight. I mean, poor Malik Andrews and that crew are like, whose pick is this? Where does this guy go? Then they wear the hat that they'll never be on that team. That makes no sense. Then the graphic behind them is the Utah Jazz as they're walking out on the stage, even though we all know it's the Wizards, and Shams has already told us that this is the Wizards' pick. Why do they keep the charade going?
I don't know.
Every other sport is like, hey, the pick just got traded. Not them. They're trading the rights, but not the pick. It's ridiculous.
It is stupid. And to me, it's an easy fix. There's just, all it is a calendar question about the CBA and when you can announce trades and when they can actually officially be consummated. Fix that immediately so you don't have to do that weird charade.
But correct me if I'm wrong, though. And maybe your date referenced is in the next 48 hours or something. Like, they do a press conference with the media right afterwards. I mean, Will Riley got on a conference call with the Wizards media 10 minutes after.
Yeah, so everybody knows, wizard. But you can't say it's official.
There's no CBA thing. There's no date.
It's July something where a trade can officially be consummated.
Okay, but in the NFL where you don't become an official commander until the start of the new league year, that conference call happens after the new league year. So you could trade for a guy in February, and then he'll meet with the media, and everyone has to pretend until then, even the team on the record, they can't say that they've added this guy. That's not what happens in the NBA.